Hello and welcome to USSOcast, a US Studies Online podcast. In this series, we chat to PhDs and ECRs about their research, their life in academia, and all things in between. Today, I'm joined by Georgia Vesma, a PhD student at the University of Manchester, working on women photographers active during the Vietnam War. Also joining us is Sarah Collier, a PhD student at University College London, researching military masculinities in narratives of the Iraq War. Firstly, thank you both so much for joining us. It really means a lot. George, if we could start with you, do you want to tell us a little bit more about your research?
Yeah, sure. Where should I start? Okay, I'm in the what should be the final year of my PhD, my third year. My project is about a group of women who traveled across the world during what we think of as the years of the American conflict in Vietnam. So starting in about 1961, coming up to the reunification in 1975, these women who traveled from the UK, France and America to work as photojournalists during this time. These are pretty much all white women. They're pretty much all middle-class women. Their sort of national backgrounds mean that they have sort of colonial history in relation to Vietnam. And I look at how their gender shapes their work and then also how their work generally shapes gendered perceptions of the conflict, which is a conflict that's understood very much in terms of gender when we think about the iconic images of that conflict, and not just gender, but also images of children and things like that. So yeah, it's kind of it's at once an incredibly narrow project. I look at basically 10 people and also one that covers a lot of really big fields around visuality, around gender, around conflict, and tries to answer some big questions about what it means when a woman's holding a camera in a war zone.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I've got a few questions that I want to kind of send in your direction. But first, Sarah, do you want to talk about your research?
Yeah, sure. So I look at representations of the war on terror. So looking at military masculinities in narratives of Iraq, a little bit of Afghanistan. I take quite a broad approach, so I'm looking at literary responses. I'm currently looking at a chapter on the war on terror on screen, and then I'm going to move on as well to sort of digital imagery and a bit of video games as well in the future. So yeah, I'm in my second year at the moment, so there's kind of a lot floating around. But I find it interesting, Georgia, what you say about what it means for a woman to be behind the camera, and especially with representation of children, because incidentally, I'm currently looking at representations of the child in The Hurt Locker. So you can kind of see a merging of those two things there. It just like came to mind as you were saying that you're looking at representation of children, because I think that's so it's really important at the moment for my at my stage of research, but in relation to masculinity and how masculinity is constructed against the child, which is very much representative of like the project of the homeland and stuff.
Also an absolutely huge theme in Vietnam conflict imagery. And The Hurt Locker was directed by a woman, right?
Exactly, yeah. She's the first woman to win, person, the only woman, I think, to win Best Picture and Best Director.
So there's a sort of some interesting crossover there then in terms of a kind of to use maybe a contentious term, but like a woman's way of seeing, or a way of seeing that's acceptable when a woman is making the visual decisions and then like putting children in the picture and using children. So I've got like a whole chapter about mixed race children, the children of American soldiers who were stationed in Vietnam and had children with local women, and how sort of these adoptions are used to like valorize these men who, you know, fathered these children, often had wives and girlfriends back in America. It's sort of, definitely part of the production of a very specific kind of masculinity and a backlash against some of the images of violence against children that are very central in the conflict as well.
Definitely. I wonder what, because again, I suppose my background is looking at, I don't look an awful lot at photography, although I probably should. So I'm sure this conversation will have me looking at more photography later on. But because I look at it from sort of a film perspective, when I think of Vietnamese children on film, I think of the very young female sniper in Full Metal Jacket. And I wonder how much, how much is your research influenced by children on film as much as on in photography, if at all?
I think it's almost the reverse in that I think that, so there was only actually one Vietnam film made during the American presence in Vietnam. It's much more a project that's sort of culturally taken on in the States in the aftermath to try and sort of unpick what the conflict meant. So there's actually quite a lot of times where you can see that the photography that was being taken at the time becomes significant to the filmmakers who are then making the film. So certain imagery is really, has quite a long life. We can think about a lot of these sort of iconic photographs of the conflict, but there's also, certain figures like, sort of child, like children who are implicated in the violence, but also like women warriors and sort of like these very beautiful but treacherous women. And there is in Apocalypse Now, for about 1 second on screen, there's a woman photographer, which is really interesting to me, especially because one of the photographers that I am interested in, Nancy Moran, was a consultant photographer on the film. So I wonder if she was sort of, like if it's a reference to her, but I haven't really thought about film a lot. I would say that if you're interested in the Vietnam War historically, it's probably because you watched a film at a crucial moment in your life. That's definitely what happened to me. But it's not something that comes through in my research. So other than film, you said you're sort of also looking at like literary approaches. Are there particular texts that you've been getting into?
Yeah, so I've been looking at how the war or kind of like the bridging or collision of the war and home spaces. So I'm looking at texts that deal with military experience and then kind of the process of return of the soldier, and it's sort of like what changes when the soldier becomes a veteran, and especially with it sort of in the shadow of 9/11 and what we now consider to be the post 9/11 age in literature, and all these kind of crises that followed it. So looking at I'm looking at one text by T. Geronimo Johnson called Hold It Till It Hurts, and that deals with a veteran of Afghanistan who comes back to deal with Hurricane Katrina. So looking at comparisons and sort of racial identity between the military and the home spaces and the idea of the masculine collective. I'm also looking at a text that bridges the Iraq War and the opioid crisis and the financial crisis as well. So looking kind of like at how we can consider the Iraq and Afghanistan wars as a kind of contemporary crisis in the same way that we would consider these domestic crises as such. I think that military fiction is very often categorized as kind of genre fiction, right? And I think there's kind of a big effort to bring it into kind of like the literary sphere, if that makes sense. Like there's lots of like MFA programs and like writing programs for veterans and stuff, and you see that more. And I think as time goes on as well, as you get more of a retrospective and it's not sort of shaken by the immediate trauma and shock of the war, then we're seeing more writers kind of reflecting on how these wars fit in with the broader kind of political economic trajectory of the US in the post 9/11 era. Yeah.
That's brilliant. I wanted to just go back a little bit. Something you mentioned, George, about how like our first exposure to Vietnam, for example, like could be something we watched as a kid. And this is kind of an open question to both of you, really. But where are the roots to your individual projects? Kind of where are they located? Is this born from an MA project, or is it literally kind of a spark of inspiration that was born from one piece of media? I know I studied Vietnam at A-level, but one of my favorite films is The Deer Hunter. And I mean, that is a film that is extremely bound up in masculinity and war. Like, you can't not read that film. It's like just a huge story of masculinity. So yeah, I wonder, what are the kind of roots, origins to these projects? And is there like pieces of media you can point to as the start of all of that?
It would be hard for me to pick a thing that's the start of all of it, except for I am of the age where you did the Vietnam War in, I think, year 10 history class, and I remember it being very really sticking with me. In terms of the origin of my project, really, it's more to do with the fact that my undergraduate degree was in art history, so I'm a visual cultures historian, and when I decided to quit the workplace and go back to do a master's, I decided to do a master's in history, but I really wanted to focus on visual material. I wanted to make stuff that was about pictures, about seeing.
Yeah.
And in the course of that, I sort of, you know, a few months in, I was like, actually, I'd really like to do a PhD. And I was starting to write a proposal about World War One and the sort of earliest origins of art therapy. And while I was sort of trying to hack that proposal together, I got a text from my then fiance, now husband, saying, like, have you heard of this photographer, this French photographer, Catherine Roy? Just read about her. And I read about her. And I was like, I've got to write my MA thesis about her. I've got to write a PhD about her. I have to. There's an archive of her work in Paris, which is about four shoeboxes. I went to Paris and saw it. From there, I wrote my MA thesis about her. I wrote my proposal about, my idea was about women photographers, Vietnam, and like the peace movement and the sort of feminist movement of the 60s and 70s. And in practice, like basically none of that came through, and it's much more about, it's less about big movements and more about individual experiences. But I mean, whose proposal ends up the same as their project? Definitely not mine. So it was literally getting a random text from my husband one afternoon that sent me on this course.
That's great. Now, you kind of started by saying you didn't have that kind of touch paper moment, lying in the touch paper. I think that's such a great example. I really love that. Sarah, what about you? What are your origin stories, I guess?
So I kind of had a bit of a roundabout journey to my PhD in English. I actually did my master's in French literature, so I looked at masculinities in narratives of the Algerian War. I've always been really interested in wars of decolonization, and so that kind of brought me around Vietnam as well, because I always knew that I wanted to return to English for my PhD. So I started thinking about bridges between the Algerian War and the Vietnam War, obviously with the French being implicated there too. Mm-hmm. And that just got me thinking to the contemporary, because I've always centered my studies in English on contemporary lit and film. So I hadn't actually looked an awful lot into representations of the war on terror until I decided I wanted to pursue this PhD project. And then I started delving into this kind of body of work of veteran writers, looking into films and thinking more about how the legacy of Vietnam, I guess, kind of like haunts the war on terror, or representations of the military and ideology in the 21st century. And so that's kind of where I started.
That's great. I mean, you spoke into this a little bit just then, and I wondered if you had anything extra to say, and Georgia as well, jump in. You've both chosen really specific, you know, conflicts, I guess, Vietnam and the Iraq War. how much do you see your methodologies and your kind of theorization of these things applicable across a range of American conflicts? Or is it very important to you to stick to that specific conflict that has its own parameters and conditions and kind of exists on its own, I guess? I mean, Vietnam is a great example of being, it's so discrete as a conflict, for example. So yeah, I wondered what you thought about that.
I mean, I would say it's almost a bit of an anxiety of mine about my project that it's quite, because the thing about Vietnam, it, photographically, that's important, perhaps, mm-hmm. is that this is the first and last, we will say loosely, time that photographers could basically do whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
Like, it's, it, as they had to be licensed by MACV, they had to, you know, provide some credentials, but once they were there, they could, you know, if they could point their camera at it, they could show it and it would be published. And that obviously had huge implications then going forward into the Gulf War and the war on terror. It's sort of the precursor to sort of modern embedding practices and the sort of, you know, a policy of much greater United States military control over journalistic material that comes out of conflicts. So on the one hand, it's kind of an important turning point. On the other hand, it isn't, you can't apply your same methodology. Mm-hmm. Because photographers were having a completely different experience to what they had in Korea, to what they would then go on to have in the Gulf. It's a moment, and it's an important moment. And I think it's an important moment because it also lines up with things that were changing for women more generally. But again, I sort of, even though it coincides with this important time in women's rights, the photographers that I'm looking at basically don't want to align themselves with the feminist movement. They don't think mm-hmm. it's important to them. So I thought that I was doing this thing that sort of had quite far-reaching implications, and it's ended up being much more about, at least in the minds of the people that I'm writing about, these are stories of like individual exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. And so making that apply more broadly is hard.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. I mean, Sarah, what about you?
I suppose it's like a kind of a similar approach to Georgia. I found that, again, I obviously started my PhD sort of mid-Trump, and thinking about how do the echoes of the war on terror under Bush and then Obama, how are they shifting, or how are they coming potentially to an end under Trump? Which is one of the anxieties of my project, because I'm thinking about like the temporal parameters of what I'm talking about, and where does that end for me? Because of course the war on terror is officially over, but it's not really. And so trying to locate it very specifically to probably like from 9/11 up to maybe sort of 2007, 2008. Mm-hmm. And I think that is informed as well by the emergence of the internet as a tool of communication. And so I'll be looking at some military blogs, but very specifically, obviously around 2003 time, blogs were quite rudimentary, and it was a very sort of nascent internet. So looking very specifically at how that is shaping military masculinity, as opposed to perhaps Twitter, might do nowadays.
It's really great to hear how focused and specific your periodization is, like for both of you. I know in my own research, it feels like every day my periodization kind of expands by 1 year either side, and it's just getting bigger and bigger. So I really admire the specificity that you two have striven for. I want to delve a little bit deeper into the primary materials you're both using, if I can. So Georgie, you mentioned you said a narrow field, then you said 10 photographers, which 10 photographers seems like a really big undertaking in like the best possible way. So how did you kind of come to that figure? Are they all equally important? You need all of them to kind of reflect and bounce off one another. How did you kind of come to that pool of material?
I mean, I came to the pool of material by looking as hard as I can and finding as many as I could. So there was quite a lot of women journalists in Vietnam during the war years. The majority of them were writers. Mm-hmm. And what has happened over the course of my PhD, including this happened to me like 4 weeks ago, is I'll think that I've got the definitive list of Western women photographers who were in Vietnam between 61 and 75, and then I find another one. Someone will just mention offhand, like, oh, and of course, something that Jill Cremens was doing this. And I'll be like, who is that?
Why don't I know about them?
I'm supposed to be the most knowledgeable person in the world on this like particular subject, and I don't even know that. No, they are not all equally important to my research. No, they are not all necessarily even particularly strongly represented in the thesis. They might just be mentioned in passing. I would say that a really key part of my argument is that you can't generalize about them. You've got ones who thought the war was great. You've got ones that thought the war was terrible. You've got ones who never basically took what we would think of as combat photographs and stuck around Saigon and took photos of street children. And then you've got ones where the only photographs that they thought were worth taking were ones of, you know, guns and helicopters. My whole point is that, well, if we can't generalize about their photography based on the fact that they're women, what can we say? And what you can say is that they were seen differently. Like, the people who were in their pictures perceived them as women and reacted to them as women. The people who published their pictures saw them as women and reacted to them as women. They saw themselves in a particular way that was informed by gender. So it's much more about a sort of cultural figure of the photographer than it is about sort of making any particularly general statements about what a woman photographer is or was in the context of the Vietnam War. In terms of the primary material I use, it's just really hundreds of photographs in varying states of horrible condition. You find them on ProQuest in historical newspapers, and they're just, you know, black and white, very, very bad reproductions. In some cases where it's a bit more of a significant photographer, there's good digital scans provided by the archives. A couple of the archives even keep their letters and notebooks, which is good. It would be great if I could go to those archives, yeah, but I can't. There's like a huge volume of material, and I've had to sort of balance in the project between, I did like a big tagging project. So, you know, categorizing all these pictures, how many of these have American men in them? How many of them have children in them? And then once I've sort of sorted these, it's about 700, 800 photos into chunks, I then pick case studies that sort of exemplify what I want to say about those chunks. So it's been quite it's definitely been a balancing act between sort of demonstrating like, yeah, I've got tons of material and I've looked at it and I know about it, versus my methodology, which is very close reading focused. And, you know, I might spend 3,000 or 4,000 words on a single photo. If I was going to do that for every photo, I would be writing forever.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of these photographers being othered by nature of them being women, but also there's European photographers as well. In terms of the reception of these photographs and authenticity and questions of that and how the media were dealing with them, what are the discrepancies between the American photographers and European? Is there anything you found there? Because obviously, as you said earlier, you know, Vietnam is a conflict that has its roots in Europe. So it's natural that they would come over and undertake this work.
I mean, one of the things I think that makes it natural, because there's more French photographers than any other nationality.
Oh, really?
I think for them it was that they knew they would be able to get by. Like, you could speak French there and they would understand you. If you spoke English and French, you would be fine. So I think it was kind of like, maybe this is a bit of an unfair way to categorize these women, but I see it as a little bit like a gap year experience for them. Like, they were generally pretty middle class. You know, they saved up to pay for their plane ticket. Just as often they'd go there with their boyfriend of the time. And it was, you know, like an adventure, but not so much of an adventure that they were really out of their comfort zone. I wouldn't say that you can detect, again, any sort of like big pattern of difference between how French photographers and American photographers, what they showed. Certainly when they talk about their work, I think there's more evidence that the French photographers had quite a complex perspective on the conflict.
Yeah, and kind of relationship to that space, yeah.
Yeah, and
sort of at once like thought it was a bad war but had a lot of sympathy for the Americans who were fighting it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Katrina Loa called American Marines her brothers. There's some amazing photos by Mary Lauderdecker where it's obvious that the men she's taking pictures of are just flirting with her. Like, she was a model. Just an incredible looking woman, and there's just all these pictures of men like posing for her with their shirts off and stuff, like that are sort of have this really strange dynamic of being explicitly critical of the conflict but really quite sympathetic to the men who are fighting it, which is like an interesting
sort of thread to pick at when you think about the conflict more generally. Because there was this big American project in the later years of the conflict and then the sort of decades following to recast the Vietnam veteran as a victim, right? Like,
yeah,
that he was victimized by basically everyone from the American government onwards and sort of forced to do things he didn't want to do and, you know, isn't complicit in the things that we know happened, but instead is just sort of an unwilling participant.
Yeah, for sure. Sarah, do you want to talk about your relationship to your primary material? You mentioned video games, actually, and kind of going into video games. I'm really interested to hear about that, but feel free to talk more generally as well.
Yeah, so I guess on the video games, that's still somewhat on the horizon for me. But I'm hoping to be looking at Call of Duty and also America's Army, which is the official recruitment game of the Army, which I'm looking forward to thinking about in terms of masculinity and how masculinity is used as a tool to support militarizing ideologies and imperialism. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I haven't thought an awful lot about that yet, but that's kind of the platform I'll be taking there. In terms of the literature and the film that I'm studying at the moment, is what's been quite difficult for me to get my head around, I suppose, is the fact that there's constantly new material being released, and so I think that I found like the perfect text to support my argument, and then something will come out that I think is interesting, and I've got to kind of juggle whether it's worth kind of rethinking and putting something else in, and so it's changed quite a lot in that respect. I've actually, for the film, I've actually settled on the big ones. There aren't an awful lot. There's not a romance to Iraq films in the same way that there is around Vietnam films, which I find quite interesting in itself. But I'm looking at Good Kill, which is about drones, and then The Hurt Locker, and then American Sniper as well. So the big popular ones, primarily because I want to look at how sort of ideologically potent these films are and what they do with masculinity to either undermine or to reinforce and reify hegemonic military masculinity as a militarizing ideology. Yeah. I mean, 3 years ago, I wouldn't have thought that I'd be dedicating so much of my life to watching American Sniper over and over again. I'm quite happy with where I've decided on my text now. It's quite a weird one because I suppose for other projects that I've done, it's been that I like the text and I want to write something about it, and I've got to find something to write about the text. Whereas it's kind of the other way around for this project, where I have a critical framework that I want to explore, and I'm trying to find which texts are the best to exemplify that.
Yeah, I mean, you're both working with such a variety of material and kind of synthesizing a lot of primary material, which I guess is a way I like to work as well. And so I really just like hearing about your process there. You've both spoken towards this a little bit already. So if you feel like you're repeating yourself, just give me the nod. But how much do things change over the period you're looking at? Obviously, you're both looking at slightly different yearly periodizations, but how different from the start of that period to the end are things? Sorry, I just saw the chat. I was going to mention 6 Days in Fallujah, actually. So that was like an old video game, wasn't it, from like early noughties? And they've remade it.
Yeah, super controversial.
Yeah, so controversial. Yeah. So how that will be dealt with in the kind of contemporary moment, I don't know. But yeah, something to think.
Why bring it back now?
Like,
yeah, it's like 100%. No one's calling for this kind of video game. You know, there is a saturation of military video games.
War, yeah.
Extremely violent, bloody, you know.
And also, I guess, and I suppose this is like Call of Duty in a nutshell, but how they're all about the War on Terror, even when they're not about the War on Terror.
Yeah.
And I think you can probably say that about a lot of films as well that kind of come after Iraq. Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I didn't frame that question very well, so feel free to take it however you can run with it however you want to. But I guess, is tracing changes across your periodization important to you, or are you just kind of looking at, right, here's a set period and things relatively stay the same within this period, but they're particularly novel anyway, ideologically speaking? Or is there a kind of a significant change you're tracing, I guess, is the question. It's a broad one.
Yeah. So I would say just outright, no, I'm not trying to trace a change across mm-hmm. my periodization, because I think other people have done that much better than I ever could. I am not here to say things different for women in 1975 than they are in 1961. I'm not here to say, like, does the Vietnam War change things? We know it does. We know it did.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm instead, I wouldn't say I'm even looking at continuities. I'm just trying to build a picture. I use, you know, how humanity students love to have a pun in the title of their thing. So, like, oh, I'm yeah. developing the picture, the photography pun.
Nice.
to kind of add, it's not just about adding women to photographic histories of the Vietnam War. It's not just about adding photographers to histories of journalism in the Vietnam War. It's kind of about doing all of those things and arguing that women photographers had a unique positionality that mm-hmm. no other photographer had, no other journalist had in the context of the conflict. But it's not necessarily about, like, was it different for them before or after Tet or whatever, mm-hmm. Because it got easier for women to be photographers in Vietnam once one of them had done it.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Sort of once this precedent was established, it mm-hmm. happened more and more.
Right. Sarah, what about you?
I think that tracking a change isn't one of the core imperatives of my project. Although I do notice a change. I think that because of how recent the conflicts are, you can kind of see waves of responses, I guess. The first wave, you've got things like the really famous book to come from the Iraq War, which is Kevin Powers' The Yellow Birds, and that's very kind of like sentimental. It's all about the trauma, and it's like, I think it's a bit hand-wringing. Whereas you get kind of a second wave where people are being a bit more critical. So there's a text by Roy Scranton called War Porn, which looks specifically at kind of like a fictionalized case of Abu Ghraib and the kind of toxic nature of the very, very masculine military subcultures, and how important it is that we don't consider the war to be over there, see how these kind of these toxic currents influence how we operate on a day-to-day basis in society. Yeah, and then there's also there's a few that are sort of looking back and trying to give responses that aren't just completely defined by the personal trauma of the soldier or the veteran, or not interrogating the political currents going on in the war, which I think is the first wave of, yeah, the first kind of like wave of literature tried to do, and film also tries to do, I think. I've looked at a text called Spoils, which is by a writer called Brian Van Riet, which takes seems to take the case of Jessica Lynch and her capture and kind of reappropriate her story so that it isn't just completely dominated by the media narrative that tried to paint her as a very vulnerable damsel in distress, kind of like white blonde white blonde princess kind of a character, and try to give her agency within this narrative and explore the subjectivity of the female soldier, which is obviously complicated by the fact that it's written by a man. But that's the kind of things that I'm looking at there. So yeah, so that's a long way of saying that whilst there's no, it's not a core current running through my project about tracking any changes, but it definitely is visible as we get more distance from the war. I think we're finding more critical lenses, yeah.
That's brilliant. We're getting toward the end of the episode now. And one thing that we did on the last episode of this, and I'm going to try and do going forward, is just shift away from research a little bit and just think about, I guess, your daily life as academics in academia. Such a broad question going to come at you now, but how have you found working over the last year and the difficulties it's brought? Has it been, you know, Georgia, you mentioned you can't get to archives. Obviously, that's a very significant roadblock in your research. I wonder, has that been the same for you, Sarah, or has it been more manageable? I just wonder, how have you dealt with this? Because obviously it's something we're all still dealing with, and it's affected our work lives.
I mean, I don't know how real do we get on the US.
You can get as real as you want, believe me.
It has been disastrous. Okay. It's been really bad. I my mental health just completely disintegrated. My ability to work more or less left me for months at a time. And I don't mean like my ability to write, I mean my ability to read. I couldn't do anything. I'm still really struggling to do anything. Like certain things have made it better, like trying really hard to maintain a community in absentia. The community is a huge part of what I loved about my PhD back when it was normal.
For sure.
And just sort of trying to force a bit of structure into my days, be okay with it if I work for 20 minutes, because that's better than working for 0 minutes. But it's, yeah, I mean, not being able to get to archives is what I wrote on my extension application, but really that's not been as big a factor as just a little bit of a breakdown.
Yeah, no, I empathize with all of that. We spoke before we started recording, before we started going on air for this episode. I had felt so much the same in terms of productivity, which is such a problematic word to use anyway in a PhD, because it's just like internalized capitalism. But, you know, it is the case of what used to be a very attainable word count in a day has now become just a distant memory. Even reading a chapter requires just a Herculean effort of focus. I mean, Sarah, how have you found things?
Yeah, I mean, I've also found it quite hard. I suppose whilst I don't have the problem with archives, because lots of what I look at is online, so so it hasn't so much been a case of access for me. But I completely agree with you, Georgia, on the loss of community. I think there's just small things that you don't think about, of kind of bumping into a colleague on campus, going for a coffee, having sort of those warm wine in the plastic cup evenings. And there's something I think missing from, I feel like my like vocabulary is getting worse, or I feel like my kind of academic jargon is like slipping from my brain, which, well, isn't necessarily a bad thing, but do you know what I mean? Like there's kind of these small things that you kind of take for granted in your day-to-day, and all of a sudden you're thinking, wow, I have been in a small flat for a year now, just kind of typing away, and it's only when you look back that you realize how different it was, which is again obvious thing to say. It hasn't been like catastrophic for me, but I've definitely noticed a big difference in my productivity, and just trying to find ways to structure my day, I think.
Yeah, no, thank you both for sharing that and being as honest as you can there. I think the loss of community is something I talked about on the last episode of this USSO cast series. And I guess I just want to focus on again, getting involved in things like this, the podcast. I mean, Twitter is not the answer to any ills in this world. It's often the cause of them. But there is an American Studies community on there, and I've certainly got a lot out of interacting and speaking to people on there over the last year. I've met people such as yourselves who I would not probably have met had that not been the case. So if anyone listening to this is struggling, especially people who have just started a PhD and don't have those weekly seminars that you get to know people in and things like that, then there is a place out there, you know, where you can meet other American Studies community. researchers online. So I guess I should end really by just thanking you both for giving up your time today, talking so eloquently about your research. You don't need to worry about jargon falling out of your head in any way. It was really, really great and really insightful. I'm sure we'll have people kind of contacting us on Twitter with questions and things. That's what we hope anyway. If anyone wants to get in touch and come on USSO Cast themselves, you can email us at usso@bass.ac.uk. And thank you very much for listening.